This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for online success that helps you build the perfect website to make your business stand out. Whether you're starting a passion project or managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easy for you to create beautiful websites, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place on your terms. Unless you're a pro coding design wizard, and confession time, I'm very much not, making a quality, good-looking website can feel like one of the hardest bits of business. That's why Squarespace is here to help you every step of the way, providing fully customizable professional layouts and templates to choose from. It can also take care of those fiddly bits like device optimization, paywalls, and invoicing. So if, like me, you're more at home with manuscripts than JavaScript, Squarespace is the tool for you. Head to squarespace.com/history10 for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code history10, that's history10, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Just a warning, this episode contains a graphic description of violence. It's twilight on a spring evening in Somerset, as all the monks of Glastonbury Abbey gather round a marble tomb to watch the workmen do their job. There's a murmur of expectation as they file into the abbey church. Some younger monks are whispering and laughing. Older men hiss at them to behave themselves. There's the blast of a trumpet from outside the door, followed by echoing footsteps. And into the church sweeps a striking royal couple. It's King Edward I of England and his beloved wife, Eleanor of Castile. Now the monks shut up. Edward is a huge, intimidating man, and today is a very special day for him. Edward nods curtly to the workmen, and they begin their work removing the lid of the tomb. It's a simple job, but it's not easy. The lid is heavy, and it's lain in place for nearly 90 years. Finally, the enormous slab starts to move. At first it opens just a crack. Then the workmen drag it till the whole top of the tomb is exposed. A cloud of ancient dust fills the room as the men set the lid down with a thud on the stone floor of the abbey. King Edward I steps forward, unable to contain his fascination. The crowd of monks do the same. Then one of them leans over the open side of the tomb, reaches in, and grabs hold of something. There's a gasp as he pulls out a massively long thigh bone. He reaches back in, rummages around, then pulls out something else. It's a human skull, a gigantic one, covered in what look like battle wounds. As more bones are produced, the monk's murmuring rises to an excited chatter. Everyone knows exactly what they're looking at. Everyone knows why it matters too. The abbot of Glastonbury takes the leg bone and the skull and holds them reverently out towards Edward. Speaking French, the language of the royal court, "My lord," he says, "I present to you the mortal remains of Arthur and Guinevere, king and queen of the ancient Britons." A broad smile dances around Edward's usually stern face. He looks lovingly at his own queen, Eleanor of Castile. For years, they've enjoyed listening together to minstrels recite the adventures of King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table. Now they're looking at their real-life remains. Edward claps his hands, both in glee and as a signal. A group of royal servants scurry forwards, bringing sheaves of the finest silk. They carefully place the bones on the fabric and wrap them. Edward has decided they deserve a better tomb than the one they're currently in, which was built for them in 1191, during the reign of his great-uncle, Richard the Lionheart. He's been all over the designs. The new tomb is going to be made of black marble, with statues of lions and an effigy of what Arthur may have looked like. That's work in progress. But for Edward, seeing the bones and holding this ceremony of exhumation has served its purpose. It's a political purpose, and it speaks to the very core of his idea of what being a king is all about. The year is 1278, and Edward has been Plantagenet King of England for 6 years, ever since his clueless old dad, Henry III, died. Edward is a very different character from Henry, which is basically the only reason he's had a crown to inherit. And unlike Henry, Edward wakes up every morning licking his lips to get on with the job. This Plantagenet has some serious ambition. Edward doesn't just want to be King of England. He knows that the Plantagenet Empire used to be nearly 3 times the size that it is now. He knows that the story of the last 8 decades has been one of slow and sorry decline, with French kings snapping off great chunks of the empire across the Channel, and, at home, Welsh and Scottish rulers giving the Plantagenets the finger whenever they get the chance. For a king like Edward, that's an intolerable insult. And that's why he's decided that now the chaos of his dad's reign is over, he's going to rebuild the Plantagenet Empire from the ground up. That doesn't mean reconquering Normandy or Poitou or Anjou. Edward has a better idea than that. It's the one that's been staring every ruler before him in the face. Like King Arthur, whose huge bones lie before him, wrapped in fine silk in Glastonbury Abbey, Edward is determined not to settle for being a King of England. He wants to be King of Britain. I'm Dan Jones, and from Sony Music Entertainment, this is History. Season 4 of A Dynasty to Die For. Episode 8, A New Arthur. When Henry III chose his royal advisers, he ended up with some very untrustworthy power grabbers, which led to poor management decisions, rebellions, and at least one person in prison. Why didn't he use Indeed? Well, Indeed wasn't around back then, but it is today. Indeed is the ultimate hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and matching technology that helps you find quality candidates fast. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. When I was hiring, I didn't use Indeed either, and the process was very slow and stressful, so I wish I had. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a £100 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/dynasty. Indeed.com/dynasty. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. In the long run of Plantagenet kings, Edward I is a legend. As his nickname Longshanks suggests, he's a giant of a man. As his other nickname, the Hammer of the Scots, suggests, he doesn't mind beating up his neighbours. As we've heard in this season, Edward has been around the block by the time he becomes king. Last episode, we saw him in action at the Battle of Evesham, smashing Simon de Montfort's army and giving the order for Simon to leave the field in tiny pieces with a vital part of his anatomy stuffed in his gob. By the time his dad, Henry III, dies in 1272, Edward is 33. He's fought battles, he's lived through political crises, he's been on crusade, and he's survived an assassination attempt. He's got a wife Eleanor of Castile, who he's been with for more than half his life and is devoted to. By the time Edward is crowned, they have three surviving kids, two girls with the very Plantagenet names of Eleanor and Joan, and a boy with the very un-Plantagenet name of Alfonso. In other words, Edward is a fully formed adult by the time he gets the call to be king. He's known to his people, and he's ready to do the job. That's one reason why, although he's out of the country when Henry dies, Edward doesn't rush back to be crowned. In fact, even though his famous and talented uncle, Richard Earl of Cornwall, also dies in 1272, Edward doesn't return to England until 2 years later. He stops off on his way to do homage to the French king Philip III for the Plantagenet lands in Gascony, to make sure he secured that for the dynasty. That tells you that Edward is absolutely confident in his right to be king. He knows no one is going to challenge him for the crown, and he knows he can take his sweet time putting his own policies into place. And what are those policies? Well, Edward sees himself, quite literally, as a new King Arthur. A warrior and a statesman who's going to be the dominant player in the whole of the British Isles. To understand that, cast your mind back to season one of this podcast. You may recall that the stories of King Arthur are huge in Plantagenet England. There's a whole Arthurian cinematic universe of tales about the knights of the Round Table and the beautiful ladies they woo. What's more, people believe Arthur was a real historical figure. That belief was helped along by Henry II, who encouraged the monks of Glastonbury Abbey to claim they had the real tomb of Arthur and Guinevere on site. Richard the Lionheart once had a sword he insisted was Excalibur. Edward's uncle, Richard Earl of Cornwall, built a fantasy Arthurian castle at Tintagel, where it was reckoned Arthur may once have hung out. So when Edward and Eleanor of Castile watch Arthur and Guinevere's old bones being dug up in Glastonbury, they reckon they're looking at the real thing. Which is super exciting in its own right. But this is also a political ceremony that feeds into Edward's goals as king. Because here's the thing. If you dig deep into the Arthurian legends, you'll find that while Arthur was king of the Britons, he seems to have actually been a Welshman. The Welsh are obsessed with him, to the point they tell each other that he's not really dead, and he's going to rise again and lead them to a new era of glory. Edward isn't totally here for that kind of talk. He wants to claim Arthur for himself, to show the world that the original Arthur is dead, and that he is going to be a new incarnation of him. He's especially keen on doing that because, since the start of his reign, one of Edward's major goals has been to smash Welsh independence and make the Plantagenet crown supreme in the West. For years, Wales has been a thorn in Plantagenet England's side. Henry II and John both tried to lead armies into Wales to force the native people and their princes to obey the English crown. But Wales was too tough of a nut to crack. The wild landscape and hard people meant neither of them managed to finish the job. Throughout Henry III's reign, there was a constant cycle of Welsh rebellion that destabilised England, undermining Plantagenet power. So Edward has made it one of his biggest aims as king to sort out Wales once and for all, to stamp English authority all over Wales by whatever means necessary. He's got particular beef with a Welsh prince called Llywelyn ap Gruffydd. Llywelyn swore to obey the English in a deal he cut with Edward's dad Henry in 1267, known as the Treaty of Montgomery. But now he's gone rogue, refusing to recognise Edward as the new King of England, and he's gone off and got engaged to Eleanor de Montfort, daughter of the arch-rebel Simon de Montfort. That's a red rag to a bull. Edward didn't stuff Simon's meat and two veg in his mouth for a giggle. Simon de Montfort nearly destroyed the Plantagenet crown, and anyone who has the nerve to lay claim to his legacy, or even just his daughter, is asking for trouble. The year before, in 1277, Edward did have a first stab at dealing with Llywelyn. He raised an army, marched into North Wales, and successfully forced Llywelyn to recognise his authority, give up a huge swathe of land, and promise to be a good boy in future. But Edward has a nagging feeling Llywelyn is going to be back for another go at him. Which is why, in 1278, he's in Glastonbury, watching a monk wave King Arthur's thigh bone around. It's not just a bit of hands-on archaeology. Edward is sending a very clear warning to the Prince of Wales and his people. Mess around with this Plantagenet and watch me get Arthurian on your ass. Warmer, sunnier days are finally arriving, as outside is calling. Factor is here to make sure that however busy you get, your meals are taken care of, giving you all the energy and time to enjoy that weather. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So, no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. Treat yourself to restaurant quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and, oh yes, blackened salmon. Don't mind if I do. Make today the day you kickstart a new healthy routine and give yourself time to focus on what makes you happy. What are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/danjones50 and use code danjones50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code danjones50 at factormeals.com/danjones50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. The world's full of people celebrating their successes, but if the Plantagenets have taught us anything, it's that failing is much more interesting. So that's why I'm certain you're going to love the podcast How to Fail. The very brilliant Elizabeth Day invites guests on to talk about three of their biggest failures and what they've taught them about life. It's a great way to hear a new side to people you may think you know. Guests include Bernie Sanders, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and Stanley Tucci. Give it a try. Find How to Fail wherever you get your podcasts. The ropes lashing the boats together in a makeshift pontoon bridge strain and squeal as the sea beneath them rises and falls. The English knights kick their horses and start taking their first careful steps onto it. They eye the clouds above them warily. It's November, and at this time of year, indeed at any time of year, the weather around here can switch up in a matter of minutes. Their leader, a Gascon knight called Luc de Tany, calls instructions to his men as they file onto the pontoon bridge, testing its weight as they move carefully along it. They've got to be careful. The water below them is cold and the current is strong. They also know that once they make it safe to the other side, a glorious opportunity awaits them. This group of knights are making their way from Anglesey, the large island off the coast of North Wales, across a narrow body of water to the Welsh mainland. Once they get there, they plan to launch a surprise attack on Llywelyn ap Gruffydd, the native Welsh prince who's been Edward's public enemy number one in this part of the world for years. The creaks of the bridge get louder with every man that steps onto it. But it's well made and it holds. Before long, the first of them is riding off on the other side, the mainland, and they're forming up ready to advance on the unsuspecting Welsh leader and his council of war. The bridge has done its job. The attack is on. The year is 1282, and, just as Edward suspected when he was exhuming King Arthur in Glastonbury a few years back, the Welsh War has burst terrifyingly back into life. To be honest, this isn't a big surprise. When Edward tried to crush the Welsh in 1277, he allowed Llywelyn to keep his title of Prince of Wales, but left him and his brother Dafydd with a pitiful settlement of their own land to hang on to. Edward allowed Llywelyn to go through with his planned marriage to a De Montfort girl, and even turned up at their wedding ceremony. But these guys were never going to be chill for very long. By the spring of 1282, the harsh peace terms Edward imposed on Wales, combined with overbearing English officials treating the Welsh like second-class citizens, had riled up Dafydd so much that he started a new rebellion. Llywelyn joined him in the summer, and since then, it's been out-and-out mayhem in Wales. Edward has been trying to get a grip on things all year, but so far unsuccessfully. In the south, his ally, the Earl of Gloucester, has had his hindquarters handed to him on a plate, and Edward has sacked him as commander of the royal forces. Now the focus of operations is on North Wales. That's why Luke de Tany is leading these knights from Anglesey, which the English occupy, to attack Llywelyn in the mountains of Snowdonia. The plan is that he and Edward will launch simultaneous attacks on Llywelyn in a pincer movement, with naval support to boot. It's a good plan, but there's a small problem. Luke de Tany's blood is up. Once he gets his men across the pontoon bridge, he finds he's within sniffing distance of Llywelyn. De Tany reckons he could probably handle this himself. How hard could some disorganised Welsh fighters really be? And imagine, when Edward arrives to find the job done, he'll no doubt shower him with praise and rewards. So Luke de Tany lines up his knights and foot soldiers, gives the order, and starts to advance on Llywelyn's headquarters. Which is where it all goes wrong. It's pretty hard to get 200 knights and 2,000 foot soldiers across a pontoon bridge without someone noticing. And over the sounds of the water and the creaking boats, de Tany's forces didn't notice the men in the mountains, quietly taking their positions. As soon as his men are lined up in a column, Llywelyn sends Welsh warriors screaming in their thousands out of the mountains. Instead of doing the ambushing, Luke de Tany gets ambushed himself. As the Welsh descend, he orders a retreat, but it's too late. There's no time to get all his men back across the narrow pontoon bridge. They're surrounded and slaughtered. Some dive into the sea to swim back to Anglesey, but drown in the cold waters. Luke de Tany is killed. It's a total annihilation for the English, the worst defeat the crown has suffered since the Battle of Lewes, nearly 20 years ago. This is very much not the way things were supposed to go. And for most other Plantagenet kings, even Henry II, this would have been enough to send them scuttling back to England with their tails between their legs. Make peace, leave it, live to fight another day. But Edward I is made of different stuff. And what happens after the disaster at the boat bridge shows his ambition to be a new King Arthur is far more than just talk. Rather than running away, Edward goes all in. To be fair, Llywelyn goads him into it, sending a letter that says the people of Wales do not wish to do homage to a stranger, of whose language, manners, and laws they are entirely ignorant. That's fighting talk. In response, Edward sends orders to every county in England, demanding that every man available joins him to finish the job he started. He's mobilising the whole of England against Llewellyn. In a few weeks, an army bigger than any that's ever been seen in Wales will be advancing west. It's a smart move. Knowing he can't wait for Edward to raise the sort of hell he's been talking about, Llewellyn tries to use the momentum of his win at the Bridge of Boats to launch another lightning strike on the English positions. He tries to hit a band of English troops positioned at Bilth and give them some of the treatment Luke de Tany got. It's a terrible mistake. In a battle at a place called Kilmerry, Llewellyn rolls the dice and loses. His troops are defeated and he's cut down on the battlefield. Edward isn't there to see it, but it's his mobilisation of troops and his decision to turn what looks like a humiliating defeat into a chance to force a decisive encounter that convinces Llewellyn to chance his arm. This is the man who didn't accept defeat after the Battle of Lewes, but took revenge at Evesham. It's the guy who went on crusade and wanted to single-handedly take down Bybars, the toughest bro in the Holy Land. You mess with him at your peril. A few days after the battle, Edward gets a letter from the captain of the forces who defeated Llewellyn. It tells him that Llewellyn ap Griffith is dead, his army is broken, and the flower of his men killed. Along with it is a little present for Edward to remember this day by. It's the bloody severed head of Llewellyn ap Griffith. Once he's been killed in December 1282, Edward has his bloody head sent to the English capital and stuck on a spike at the Tower of London. Then, in the new year, he takes command of the gigantic army he's raised in response to Llewellyn's defiance. In March 1283, he launches a vast, multi-pronged, utterly merciless ground and naval invasion of Wales. The aim is not only to stamp out Welsh independence forever, it's to leave permanent physical signs of the conquest everywhere on the landscape. The mental and physical scars of that invasion can still be seen in Wales today. Edward wants to be remembered as a new King Arthur, and he's not going to let anyone stand in his way. Find out how next time on This Is History. If you can't wait for more Plantagenet action, a reminder that the next episode is already out, over on This Is History Plus, where you can listen ad-free alongside hours of subscriber-only content, where I chat with my producer about the Middle Ages. This time, I reveal the shocking chain of events that led to Richard's death, which also landed someone in a boiling river of blood. There are also hours of interviews with some brilliant historians, including Dan Snow and Philippa Gregory, where we kick back and nerd out about the past. If that sounds like your thing, come and join me. To start your free trial, go to Apple Podcasts and click Try Free, or head to thisishistorypod.com.